The therapist, Esther Perel, was at a dinner party when somebody suggested they go around the table and share what advice they would give to their 16-year-old selves. She said they'd learned so much about each other that night from the way people told their stories, because how we understand what happened to us and why things happened to us shape the stories we tell about ourselves. Our stories either energize and inspire us in life, or our stories might hold us back and drag us down. She says the stories we tell ourselves can make us or break us. Psalm 107 is Israel's origin story. It's the story that makes them stand tall as a people. The poet says in verse 2, "Let the redeemed of the Lord tell their story." Redeem is how slaves get their freedom back, when a redeemer buys out the slave's contract. This is the Exodus story, how 3,500 years ago, a population of slaves in Egypt miraculously became the proud nation of Israel. The story began with God seeking out Moses and said in Exodus 3:7, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey." For people who all their lives were treated like nobodies, who were told the only thing they were good for was to pack mud into a mold to make bricks, the Exodus story changed everything about how they thought of themselves, because the creator of the universe paid attention to them and saw their suffering. They could not have been nobodies when they actually mattered to God. And God decided they were worth rescuing at whatever the price of redemption. So for the past 3,500 years, twice every year, Jewish people would reenact some part of that Exodus story to make sure the story would be passed on and remembered by their kids, because this is the story of their true worth in creation, the story that made them special because God thought them special. Jewish poets have different images for the Exodus story, and in Hosea 11, also a reading for today, we have this adoption picture in verses 1 to 4. "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. It was I who taught them to walk, take them by the arms. It was I who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with ties of love. To them, I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek, and I bent down to feed them." This is Israel, a sick, neglected orphan God found at the Egyptian orphanage. He brought the baby home, taught him to walk, healed him of illnesses, and just loved him and instilled worth and belonging. 15 years ago, a couple in Wisconsin with three boys, decided they would adopt a little girl from an orphanage in China. They were told the baby had some vague health issues, which turned out to be a defective heart that needed a couple of major surgeries to fix. But the parents did what was needed because this was what they signed up for. They were committed to the baby's growth and well-being. Well, 5 years ago, as a Christmas present to her daughter, the mother set out to research her daughter's birth story back in China to help her fill in some of the blanks of who she was and where she came from. And what the mother found out shocked her. With some help from a local agent, she found a baby photo of her daughter sitting on the knee of her Chinese foster mother. The shocking part was, on the other knee, there was another identical baby girl sitting. Her daughter has a twin. Well, after some more detective work, they found out the twin sister had been adopted by another American family in Washington State. So that Christmas, the two sisters met for the first time. The girls described the meeting as overwhelming. They said it felt like there was something missing, and now it's complete. Maybe it's a little like how some of us felt when God found us. That because we are created in the image of God, by God, having God back in our lives feels completing in some way. So these two families became instant relatives. The two sets of parents said they were committed to make sure the two girls would get to spend time with each other and grow up together, which means parenting just got a lot more complicated for them and expensive because of all the airfare to fly one of them across the country a couple of times a year. But what a story these parents are making for these girls. Because from the moment they adopted them, they decided the daughters were worth the trouble, however much that may be. Psalm 107 is the picture of God raising his adoptive kid, the story that made Israel. But by Hosea's time, some 1,200 years later, the story had taken a turn and became the story that broke them. That cute baby of the living God grew up and became a rebel, a parenting nightmare. The grown-up Israel rejected his adoptive parent. The love and effort that went into making him who he was now felt limiting. And Israel walked out on God. Jesus told a story like that. It's the story of the prodigal son. The word prodigal means wasteful. The son didn't know what he had and threw it all away. Now, this is one of those stories that requires us to go back in time and listen to Jesus from his cultural perspective, because we might miss his point if we listen from our modern Western cultural point of view. Jesus lived in a time when people are known as a family and not so much as individuals. So while we would encourage young people to be independent and to go find themselves when they turn 18, this is not something the ancient world understood. For them, as long as the dad is alive, sons have no identities of their own or legal standing in society. They live as someone belonging to their dads. And when their dad dies, they inherit the dad's identity and are expected to carry on the dad's legacy. So the gut punch in Jesus' story is how the kid comes and says to the old man, "Look, I can't wait around for you to kick the bucket before I can finally start living my life. So just give me my inheritance and let's just do like you just died. And we will just part company from here on in." So in Jesus' time, this is a really, really ingrate of a son, a dirtbag of a human being with no sense of decency. So the first surprise of the story is that the dad actually goes along with the vulgar request. In real life, the son has no claim on the dad's wealth except for an adequate living allowance. And dad has every right to be angry or even to punish or disown the son. But he doesn't. He gives the son what he wants. At this point of Jesus' story, we follow the son into the world, something like Vegas, where he lives high on the hog, throws cash around left and right, living like a rock star hanging around with the wrong crowd. And Jesus leaves the dad back home. He doesn't give us any inner monologue where the dad shares what he's feeling or thinking, except we're told every day the dad is on the porch waiting, looking out down the street as far as he could see, hoping to see his son has come home. But Hosea 11 gives us an idea of how God feels about his rebel son through Hosea as a man trying to hold his family together when the people he loves don't love him back. Hosea is the first installment of a book called the Book of the 12 in the Jewish Bible. The Book of the 12 is a story of God's response to the world he created turning unjust and abusive. In Hosea, Israel sold out God because just like Adam and Eve in Genesis, they mistook God's protection and provision as a hindrance to the quality of life. They wanted to take on life on their own terms without having to worry about God, so they ditched their family identity. They wanted what the world considered success, like power and status, and they were willing to trade God for it, even if it meant playing dirty. Hosea is a really hard story to read. Some say the hardest in the Bible because of the difficult poetry and the storyline. It's about a man with a promiscuous wife who keeps running away from home to seek intimacy with other men. Hosea says God told him to marry her, and God also told him to journal the pain of his dysfunctional marriage because what he feels, trying to love his wife who doesn't love him back, is what God feels, trying to love Israel when Israel doesn't love God back. How Hosea's heart breaks for his wife is how God's heart breaks for Israel. In Hosea's time, wives call their husbands master. It's the Hebrew word Baal or Baal, which is also what people call the fertility god in the ancient Near East world. He's the rain god, responsible for giving rain in a world where farming means life and death for people. So people carve wooden statues to bow to and make sacrifices to, and they worship Baal with wild sex parties because that's how Baal likes to be worshipped. As a grown-up Israel lives and does business in the world, it is inevitable that he finds himself in rooms where non-Jewish people are praying to Baal or making gifts to Baal or swearing oaths to Baal to seal a business deal. And Israel might have started off just playing along, you know, just to be polite. But over time, he finds himself praying to Baal too, especially in moments when he feels worried about his future or the economy of war or illness. And why not only to cover the bases and hedge the bets, just in case God is distracted or slow to answer, or worse, God says no to whatever he asks. Besides, Baal worship is a lot more fun than doing animal sacrifices at the temple. Baal is into things that he is into. Being decent doesn't matter to him, and he can be bought off with a bribe. And even the priests in the Jewish temple gave people what they wanted. When people came there to pray, they could also pray to Baal and get a Baal blessing from the priests. And if they had a gift for Baal, the priests were too happy to accept it on his behalf. So in Hosea, we have God venting his pain of betrayal, like the passage starting in 7:11 from the Message. Israel is bird-brained, mindless, clueless, first chirping after Egypt and fluttering after Assyria. I'll throw my net over them. I'll clip their wings. I'll teach them to mind me. Doom. They've run away from home. Now they're really in trouble. They've defied me. And I'm supposed to help them while they feed me a line of lies. Instead of crying out to me in heartfelt prayers, they whoop it up in bed with their whores, gash themselves bloody in the sex and religion orgies, and turn their backs on me. I'm the one who gave them good minds and healthy bodies, and how am I repaid? With evil scheming. Well, not words we like to hear in church. God is mad because his kids are deluding themselves with a made-up God of their own invention. Wooden idols don't speak, God says in Hosea 4:11. The Baal religion is scamming you of your money and your ethics, because idolatry is not a victimless crime. Societies that chase after power and prestige usually leave the poor and vulnerable in the dust or eat them for lunch. In Baal's world, the vulnerable don't matter. He favors bullies. Only the bottom line matters. And this is what society was becoming around Hosea. This is how the historian Thomas Cahill puts it. For the prophets like Hosea, there's a profound link between idol worship and injustice. Baal is the god of human desires. He can bestow power and riches, prestige and victory, and can be wheedled into doing so by some rigmarole or other, some offering. But our God is the God of heaven and earth, who has told us that the only acceptable offering is justice, his justice, to treat others fairly and compassionately and never to stoop to the cruelty that these quid pro quo transactions can entail, things as hideous as the sacrifice of children. Baal is dividing the Israel population in two. The rich are the idolaters and the sacrificers of children. The poor are the righteous. Baal is still worshipped in our modern world. He just goes by different names now. There's a lot of talk right now about the decline of Christianity. Recently, a professor who taught me in Regent said this in a podcast. Actually, he says, Christianity is thriving in places like Africa or China or even the Middle East. It is only struggling here and in the UK and America and Australia because we worship the good, comfortable, materialistic life and spend our energy and resources chasing after that rather than pursuing the things that God cares about. Much of the book of the 12 is like Hosea, God chasing down his rebel children, warning them about the pitfalls of worshiping the wrong things, but most of the warnings fell on deaf ears. The people were quite happy with their lives. If anything, they felt like maybe they have outgrown their adoptive parent. But despite all the tough talk in the book of the 12, ultimately, the writers were reminding people what God was like as their adoptive dad. That even though they had walked out on God, God had not given up on them. The writers were inviting people to turn back to God because they were convinced God wanted them back and God could fix what they broke. So from the bottom of the spiritual pit, God says in Hosea 11, 8-9 from the Message, but how can I give up on you? How can I turn you loose, Israel? How can I leave you to be ruined and devastated? I can't bear even to think such thoughts. My insides churn in protest. So I'm not going to act on my anger. I'm not going to destroy Israel. And why? Because I'm God and not a human. I'm the Holy One and I'm here in your very midst. The son in Jesus' story also landed in that same pit. When he ran out of money and found himself in a pigsty competing for pig slop. And just like ancient Israel, the prodigal son found himself thinking about dad when he hit bottom. That his dad was not just good to his sons, but also good to the farmhands. So the son thought to himself, even if he could not be a son to his dad again, maybe he could beg for a job on the farm as a farmhand. Maybe he could appeal to the dad's kindness. So the son set out for home because he remembered what kind of man his dad was, and he decided to bet everything on that because he was out of ideas. Why Jesus told the story about a kind dad, what he wanted his listeners to know was whatever happens in our stories with God, whatever wrong turns we take in our lives that lead us away from God, however we think we might have messed up and made him mad and think less of us, the most important thing about God for us to remember is that he's compassionate, gracious, and kind, and utterly committed to us. This is the whole message of the Bible, what all the writers learned over thousands of years of history with God. And remembering that God loves us no matter what changes everything about our story with God. There's a young man who gave a TED talk about the time he peed his pants in school when he was 5 years old. He was sitting in class, squirming at his desk, but there was some rule about how only one kid can go at one time and some other kid already went. So this boy didn't know what to do. And so he peed his pants. When the teacher saw the puddle around the boy's feet, she came over and asked what happened. The boy was desperate to not get into trouble, so he thought maybe he could say he spilled his water bottle. But of course, water wasn't that color. So the boy said, I spilled my juice. The teacher said, well, you know, you're not supposed to bring juice into the classroom. The boy said, sorry, I will not do it again. So he got away with it. Except when he got home, he felt really bad. He wondered what kind of person he was if he was willing to lie to save his life. Did lying make him a bad person? Does the end justify the means ever? Well, he's studying to be a philosopher in university. Now, as I think about his story, I wonder, did he really have to lie, though? Was his teacher really so mean that she would not let a kid go to the bathroom if he really, really needed to go? Or did this thing happen actually because the kid believed his teacher to be that mean and rigid and cannot be reasoned with? That he peed his pants because he didn't know he could expect kindness and compassion from his teacher? And once that happened, he expected punishment, not kindness and understanding, so he lied to save his life. But what if he was wrong about what kind of person his teacher was? Because that would have saved him from having to lie. Jesus told the prodigal son's story to get the people to remember who God was and what he's like in a time when Israel had forgotten who God was to them and what they meant to God. God had not changed. He was still deeply invested in their well-being, much more than any other gods and snake oil salesmen. Like when Israel was suffering in Egypt as slaves, when nobody else cared, God cared and came to the rescue. So maybe from the spiritual pit, it was safe to cry out to God again and to go home again. And it's Hosea's message to the people, hoping they would come to their senses. God does not ever give up on the people he loves. He stands by, always saying, "Turn back to me. We can fix this." This is why when Jesus' cousin John the Baptist began inviting people to be baptized in the river as a sign of the desire to turn back to God, they were primed and ready. And they turned up in droves to sign up because they've been waiting for a sign from God for a long time. At that, it was safe to come home again. Like Israel, Jesus, as the prodigal son in the pigsty, came to his senses and decided to go home. If the people listening to Jesus' story were surprised that the dad went along with that ingrate son's request, they were now practically hissing at what happened next. The dad, who had been out every day on the porch waiting for his son to come home, the moment he catches sight of his son on the road, the dad runs like a crazy man to meet him because he can't wait a minute longer to wrap his arms around that son. The son is given a hero's welcome. To his surprise and the surprise of the people listening, he is still his father's son. So much for begging for a job on the farm. And what's more, the dad orders the servants to bring out that bull that they've been fattening up for a special occasion. There's going to be a party, a feast to celebrate the son's return. The guy who wrote the book Everything Sad Isn't True, Daniel Nayiri, tells the story of when he was 3 years old and went to meet his Iranian grandfather for the first time. When he stepped into his grandfather's yard, there was a commotion and yelling, and he turned a corner and saw four men from the village trying to hold down a bull. He says the bull looked at him with these sad eyes and then let out a sound like opening your mouth and trying to push all the food out of your stomach. At that moment, his grandfather stepped out of the house, picked up a knife, and slit the throat of the bull. Blood poured everywhere, all over the grandfather's feet and hands and clothes. He looked at his grandfather. His grandfather smiled at him and touched his cheek with his bloody hands. He writes, "The men stepped back, relieved and embarrassed. The bull collapsed. My mother must have been the one who screamed. My vision went black. She had covered my eyes. I heard her say, 'Oh, Masood,' as if my dad should have known. Underneath her hand was the color red. My next memory is back at the car outside the walls, mom very angry, dad kind of laughing because whatever, farm life, you know. He thinks she's overreacting. She won't go back until they clean up the blood." He explains the men were running late. The bull should have been slaughtered hours ago. My grandfather's only grandson, me, had come. What else did she expect? It occurred to me at this point that the feast was for me. The bull must have known I was the right person to beg. I could have saved it. My 3-year-old brain doesn't know what that even means. When I tell this story, I don't tell anyone about this part. I was just a little kid back then. Still, I just wonder if they've had that feeling too. The one where you realize it's your fault that something beautiful is dead. And you know you weren't worth the trouble. I wonder if the son in Jesus' story thought about that. That the bull died because of him and whether he was worth the trouble. That son had no business expecting a feast when he came home, but he got one anyways, because that's the kind of person his dad was. And Jesus reassures us with this story that we can always expect God to be happy to see us because that's the kind of God he is. That whatever we have done, we are always worth the trouble. If we ever doubt it, we just have to remember Christmas and Easter and why Jesus came. Jesus, Son of God, coming into our world is the assurance for anyone who thinks God is mad at them and their relationship with him is broken forever. But Jesus comes to correct that. And for Jewish people who prepared for worship by the blood offering of an animal to make up for their sins, they believed Jesus was their sacrificial lamb who shed blood to redeem them back from the slavery to sin and be God's children again. In the prodigal son story, the dad is God, the son is any of one of us wanting to come home to God, and Jesus, I guess, is the fattened bull who gave his life so there could be a family reunion, a party to celebrate the child coming home. Because Jesus wants us to know that we're worth dying for. We're worth his sacrifice, and we're always worth his trouble. Take a moment to begin a conversation with God, and Malcolm Guite has a Psalm 107. Psalm 107. My judge is still my savior and my friend. Time after time he finds me and rescues me, makes a beginning where I've made an end. I was astray, and yet he came to me and filled my hungry soul with nourishment. I sat in darkness, bound in misery, crushed by depression and discouragement. He brought me out of darkness, broke the chain, the complex links of my imprisonment. When I was sick and wearied and in pain, afraid of pestilence in these dark days, he sent his word and raised me up again. So I will sing the psalm that sings his praise, telling of all the wonders he has done, whose loving kindness keeps me all my days. Amen.